Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland
on News Talk.
So our esteemed business panel are here in the shape of Nora Casey, who is an old colleague and indeed a businesswoman, broadcaster, journalist. Also, James Lutet is joining us, a new man on the papers and on the Business Review. He's from Impactful Limited. So you're both very welcome and a happy Easter to you both.
Happy Easter, Bobby. Yeah.
Thanks for having us in.
Now we'll have a look at the first story, James. Thousands of new homes at risk as Irish Water cannot connect them. Front page of the Irish Mail. This is an interesting story from my perspective in that it says to me that this is Irish Water talking through the media, saying to the government, if you don't give us more money, we're not going to give you any more houses.
Yeah, I think they're taking the opportunity to have the conversation here and open it up and say, we need more money, we need more funding to help build these new houses. But I do think we should call this out. Like, well done. We've spotted a potential problem here, right? We've seen something before we start to build the houses that might come back and bite us down the line. So I do think there's value in having this conversation up front. Are some of these houses in the wrong places to build because the water infrastructure is difficult to get there?
Yeah. And Nora, I don't know what your own take on that. That was my initial reaction that, you know, the Irish Water can effectively hold the government over a barrel here. Yeah. And say, if you don't release funds, we ain't going to give you houses. And the last thing the electorate wants to be doing is telling the people we're struggling with the house numbers.
As it's Easter, I'm going to say it's chicken and egg.
Yeah.
Because basically, Irish Water are saying, if you don't give us money, we won't grant permission. And Bord Pleanála says we can't grant permission without having Irish Water signing off. I think the real issue that undercuts all of this is the chairman, Gerry Grant. Like, I'd love to be chairman of an organisation where you can stand up and say the state of the water and the sewage system is desperate in Ireland. And really, it's nothing to do with me, because the government needs to give me 1.7 billion immediately to make 50,000 new homes, because previously it said it would be 33,000. And by the way, I'd be looking to 50 to 60 billion up to 2050 in order to fulfil our commitments.
And what does the government say? But, you know, what can the government do?
Well, the government says, let's set up a new body to look at all of this and to cut through the nonsense. We have to have a detailed plan. And meanwhile, everyone's carving up the Apple money.
Absolutely unbelievable. Let's move to energy, if we can, James. A switch to clean energy may lead to price rises. The National Economic and Social Council, NESC, have written a report, Economic Council warning about the lack of clarity on future reliability of supply. One thing it's definitely telling us is that the price is going to increase.
Yeah, and I think they talk about this idea of the sort of strategic fog. They don't know what's coming down the line. It's very difficult to see what's coming down the line. And I think that's true of a lot of projects and the way that we see things. And for me, I think there's something that we're often looking far too far into the future. And sometimes we can bring things back a little bit closer to where we are and say, well, what's the next thing we should be doing? Right. And something like wind farms is a great example where you can break things down into smaller chunks. Right. You can build a wind turbine, not necessarily a whole wind farm. So you add one and add another one. And that takes a lot of risk out of a lot of that strategic fog that they're talking about.
So when you say strategic fog, as is alluded to in the article, it's about the further out you look, the more opaque the whole thing gets.
That's right.
And anything can kind of happen, and this might happen or it may not happen, or you can really say anything you want.
That's it. And that's just life, right? We don't have a crystal ball. We can't see deep into the future. So what we can do is make the best decisions, I think, that we can, based on the information we have today,
right,
based on the things that are in front of us. And we know that we're going to need energy in the future. So the question is, where are the easiest, lowest cost, highest value places to build these turbines? And let's start working on those.
Yeah.
And if there's uncertainty in the future, then that's okay. We'll deal with that in the future. We'll still be here.
Yeah, no, but we could kind of talk ourselves out of it by sort of overanalyzing something 10 years out.
That's right. And I think we've got to make progress. We've got to push forward with the things that we can do. And if there's things that we're still uncertain about, that's the world.
It's called fog.
Yes.
Well, Micheál Martin says he's going to set up a climate investment clearinghouse So that will clear the fog away. Yeah, that's they actually just get all of that green energy and solar energy and clear it out of the way so you can see into the future.
What are your thoughts on this, Nora, in terms of, you know, this economic council, lack of clarity on future reliability of supply? Is it, as James says, that we're just trying to analyse stuff that's too far out?
Yeah, I studied strategy for 2 years, went back and did advanced strategic management, then realised I couldn't see over the hill. So, you know, the biggest difficulty, I think, in the world is that everybody assumes that clean energy is going to reduce electricity prices. And actually what they're now beginning to understand is it actually could potentially increase them. And there isn't enough of it. And you can read every day of the week, there's somebody that's saying no to a wind farm or something, not in my back garden. So where does it all go? I don't know whether the investment clearinghouse is the answer, but I do think that it's about lots of different things happening at once.
Yeah. Second part of that story, James, I suppose it's energy related. Possible layoffs at SSE Airtricity as it reviews its business. I didn't realise it was quite the player that it actually is in the Irish electricity industry.
Yeah, it's a huge, huge organisation, 1,300 people across the island of Ireland. And I think this is another example of big organisations having that kind of short-term view, potentially too short-term, of we're going to get rid of all these experienced people, potentially, or restructure things. And then they're talking about doing 2 billion euros worth of investment over the next 10 years here. Well, if you had those people in your organisation, perhaps that could be 1 billion. But if you get rid of them all and you have to bring in the consultants, maybe it's going to be 3 billion.
Yeah.
So I do think there's a question there for big organisations about there's cost challenges now, but if you've got great people, if you can build them up and make them better at what they're doing, then perhaps you can get value out of them in different ways. And I think retraining and reskilling people rather than just getting rid of people, I think is a big mindset shift.
Again, it seems to be a PR-led article that's telling us to expect bad news.
Yes.
Here we go. Here's a snippet. So,
and in a world full of bad news, we just needed more of that.
Well, let's move on to some other news then.
Yes,
not
please.
Necessarily bad. The great debate is on today in the Irish Times, Nora.
Yep.
We've got Trevor White, again, somebody from the Little Museum of Dublin, a man who knows certainly Dublin tourism, and Jim Deegan there from UL, who's made major contributions to Irish tourism, debating, I suppose, can we turn the tourism crisis into an opportunity? I think the first thing is maybe there still seems to be some doubt over the numbers.
Absolutely doubt over the numbers.
And I think, you know, when until that's sort of more solid, I think we really can't have the debate, because I think the jury's out on whether the numbers are actually as bad as are being portrayed.
And we talked about it a few weeks ago when there were just early signs in January and February of the numbers being down, and it wasn't clear because the hoteliers, for once, were saying that's not our understanding. We see that they're fine. So Jim, in particular, points to the CSO stats, which says we're down on September 24, 25%. In January, 30% in February. So he's using those figures again.
Yeah.
I think it also says that Ireland is the fifth most expensive country in Europe. That's Jim's point, is that there's things strategically we need to do.
Sorry to correct you, Nora, but I think it's the second most expensive.
Second most expensive.
Yeah, yeah.
You're right. And that's a basket, isn't it, of 2,000 consumer products, and Denmark is top.
Yeah.
So he's looking at ways in which we could reasonably do something ourselves to improve our productivity, which he talks a great deal about, in order to ensure that our profit margins continue within the tourism sector. Trevor White, very tongue-in-cheek, does something totally different in his argument. And he says that, now you have to read between the lines about the US and Trump, and the Americans, as much as we love them, aren't staying as long as they used to. And that there's a climate emerging think tank coming along the lines, and that Ryanair has too big a voice for Tourism Ireland. Fall to Ireland, he says, wants 10 million visitors, and he questions whether we want them or not. Now, I have to say, as a travel writer, I go around Europe and people are actually demonstrating against tourists.
Well, we had 10 million tourists in 2019 and we seem to have deal with them, I would have said.
Quite reasonably.
Yeah, so I don't think that's an issue.
His point is, he says, do we want them in Tampa Moor or Tampa Bar?
Well, that's a fair point.
Describes Tampa Bar as a giant alcoholic theme park, which I think is a little unfair. So his point is, we do want them. We probably want them in parts of the country that don't get as many tourists as Dublin does, and that we need to do more strategically.
Yeah. James?
Yeah, I think we've got to embrace what we're good at, right? A colleague of mine had her family over this week, and she took them up to the Giant's Causeway in the rain. It was during the week, and it was chucking it down with it. They had an amazing time, right? And I think we've got to embrace what we're good at and build the capabilities of the teams we have, like the hotels or the restaurants, the tourism industry. And let's cater to the market, right? You know, people love coming to Ireland. They love the people.
And I think we're good at tourism. And like you say, I had some Americans in town for the last 10 days, brought them to sites in Dublin, Kilkenny, Kinsale, Killarney, Kilkee, Galway, Tipperary. And they had the most fantastic time in all those places.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's a beautiful country. Like, I think the bigger picture around the US is that US people aren't really traveling very much at the moment because of other reasons, nothing to do with us or our economy or tourism.
Well, the second part of what we were going to look at here was the tourism going the other way, and that is the Irish going to the States. Now, what isn't mentioned in this article, I think the dollar is 1.14 today. Yeah. Like, that's going to be the biggest influencer on whether people go to the States or don't go.
Yeah,
just like it is when they come here. But it's not mentioned in that article because, again, there's some figures here that say that in March just under 39,000 people who normally live in Ireland travel to the US. And that's 27% down compared to, say, but you've got Easter in there. And again, and you just
all kinds of differences.
Don't want to be taking just 1 month in isolation. But I think, you know, it will become attractive now as the dollar moves out to 115, 118, 120 for people to go there.
That's it. And I think that was, like, if we look at Trump, and I'm sure we're going to talk about that, like, one of his objectives, he actually laid it out when he did that big board with all of the tariffs on it, was that everybody else was undervalued, right? That the dollar was overvalued. Well, if you look at what's happened since then, the dollar's gone down by 9%.
He got his wish.
So he's devalued the dollar, which was the goal in a lot of this thing. So I think we've got to look at with what he's doing, where he's ending up versus what he's doing to get us there, because that's a whole different ballgame.
Well, that's a nice segue onto our next piece, which is the dollar's sharp decline signals the tide going out on its global dominance. And that is an interesting piece, is it not, Nora? Because, you know, when you look at the strength of the dollar over the decades, you know, really has meant that America has been able to dominate world matters and world affairs. And it looks like the few chinks that are starting to happen there really make them vulnerable.
Very vulnerable. I mean, I think US borrowing has been kept down really because of the strength of the dollar and issues around tariffs, the uncertainty in the markets. Certainly Trump has had a big effect on reshaping global trade, loss of confidence in the dollar. So I think we're probably coming to the end of the time when the dollar is the currency that people trade in, because China is getting stronger. Things like cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin are getting stronger. Once people start losing confidence in a currency, the author actually likens it to the Suez Canal in 1956. None of us remember that, but it was a disastrous attack on Egypt by the British, which saw the back of the British pound broken.
And it never really recovered.
It never recovered from it, you know. The dollar is too strong at the moment. I mean, even talking about tourism, but it is. And now, because of Trump's efforts, which should have been shoring it up, he's actually leading to a drop and a confidence crisis. I mean, Deutsche Bank has called it a confidence crisis in the dollar. So, you know, it's already out there.
Yeah, but I think that's the interesting thing is, like, dollar strength versus dollar weakness. And actually a lot of the rhetoric is around, you know, your currencies are undervalued.
Yeah.
Well, actually, from a trade perspective, if he can devalue the dollar in whatever way he does it, and like I say, he's very clever at manipulating things. Then actually that does make the American economy more competitive. And while that does have impact in terms of the ability of the dollar to be a reserve currency, it perhaps does drive some of the value that his base is looking for around sort of economic growth and perhaps mitigating some of that.
And staying with that, James, Pat Leahy's piece in today's Times has given us, he talks about our best hope is for Trump to take a few concessions as victory. It's a good piece because he tells us there's four signals there. The first one being, which I think is blatantly clear, that the markets will constrain Trump, and they've already shown their ability to do that.
Yeah, and I think that's right. I think you've got to, and a lot of people say this, you've got to separate the signal from the noise.
Yeah.
In terms of what he's saying. So if you look, I read The Art of the Deal recently because I thought I'd better get my head into what this guy's thinking because I've got to understand the guy, and he uses the conversations he has, you know, the media to have conversations and drive things in certain directions, but he uses it like a tool. He plays it like a fiddle.
Yeah.
And just because he says something doesn't mean that that's what he means. He's just getting himself out there and causing us all to talk about it.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I think that's part of the interest about watching what's going on. And if you look at what he's saying, and we're all worried about lots of things, and look at where we actually are, right? So the dollar's down 9%. That's one of the things he wanted. Everybody in Europe is now paying a 10% tariff and clamoring to go and do a deal with him. Yeah. And he's in a trade war with China.
Yeah.
Those are three things that he wanted, and they are happening. So I think it's really interesting to see actually what happens versus maybe what we hear about what he
says. Well, I think his big enemy in all this is China. So if he can do deals, even separate deals with the UK, with Europe, that alienate China further, then he'll have done what he hopes to do.
And he's almost said that he'll give preferential deals to people who won't deal with China.
Which is another thing. So we've got to be, as Europeans, we got to be careful about how close we get to China in this next couple of months.
The best, if you read nothing else, read Pat Leahy today, this article that we're talking about, because he has the funniest turn of phrase, and it absolutely resonates with me that we're all spending longer and longer on our WhatsApp, on our phones, because Trump's only waking up in the morning and we all want to know what the hell is he putting up there on Truth Social, on his own platform. And he's talking about the Eurocrats being worse. We're only 5 hours behind, you know.
So the Eurocrats an extra hour. Politicians not going to bed
because
they're waiting for the latest tweet.
I remember a time when the news was boring. My dad used to put it on and we'd all say, oh, Dad, that's so boring. And now we're all glued to it, not just at 6 o'clock, 9 o'clock and 10 o'clock, but constantly.
That's it.
Nora, what about Rory McIlroy? Aww. I know you're a big fan. He's back on home soil after his Masters triumph. He really is a fantastic ambassador for
Amazing.
Ireland Inc.
Yeah.
And there's a secondary piece there about McIlroy transcends the usual divisions in this All-Ireland game. And it's like, we're just so glad that he's part of us. And if he's part of somebody else, that's okay too.
And he made grown men cry this week, which was just amazing. I think the one great thing about the Masters this week was that it wasn't boring. That at one point we thought all was lost, that he came back from the brink. When you saw the emotion at the 18th, like he was actually gulping air in, you know, the stress of actually achieving that. And now he's one of only sixth, I think, in the world that has got that that career grand slam. And there he was, he had his daughter Poppy, and he made this lovely statement about never give up in your dreams. That's what I tell my daughter. Always follow your dreams, you know. Yeah. And he's only 35, you know, but
incredible.
He's achieved such a huge amount. And look at the feel-good factor he's given Ireland in a dismal week, as we've just been discussing.
Yeah.
That's it.
This is our positive story of the week. What about that, James McIlroy, transcending the usual divisions of the All-Ireland game? Like, Golf Ireland has probably helped because it's an All-Ireland body. Just like rugby is, so it's kind of easier when there isn't two sort of associations.
Absolutely. Like, I mean, I'm an Englishman, and in the rugby, I'll be supporting England, and that's been difficult for me for the last few years, but that's okay. But when was it at the weekend when we were staying up late to watch the playoff, I couldn't help myself. Right, I was supporting Rory, and I wanted him to win, and I was very excited. My wife and I were sitting there, and I just think. He was one of mine, even against, you know, an Englishman. So, I just think there's a feel good factor. I think he's done an incredible job, and I just everybody loves him. He's done great things.
James Luta, Nora Casey, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Have a lovely Easter.
Down to business with Bobby Kerr,
brought to you by Bank of Ireland
on News Talk.